Hello. It's been a minute, but that's the fun thing about doing a podcast for fun. I make it when I want to. And I've been reading about this case nonstop. I'd like to share it with you. You're listening to Sorry Murder. Please stay tuned for a special message at the end of the show regarding this case. How well do you know your neighbors? Whether you rent or own, do you know who lived in your house before you? Well, you might want to now. In this tragedy, where they live and who had lived there before meant the difference between life and death. This case took place in Cranbrook, BC. Cranbrook sits upon the Crow's Nest Pass Highway, which is the divider between British Columbia and Alberta. Because of this, the town can be a hot spot for travelers who are passing through. Cranbrook is located in the Kootenay Mountains, which is an incredibly beautiful area, full of clean rivers, farms, mountains, hippie towns, old settlements. It's a fantastic area to visit, and one would imagine, to live. Cranbrook is smaller. As of 2016, around 20,000 people lived there. Small towns can get a bad rap, and I understand that living in a small community that has big city problems. I don't want to stigmatize Cranbrook, but I will say that from looking at various court documents and news articles, it does appear that there has been, or perhaps still is, a bit of an issue with gangs. For one thing, this may be perhaps due to the location being right on the British Columbia-Alberta border. It does make it an easy stop for running drugs and other criminal activities. Since this case, the police have been cracking down on gang activity, but let's look at a few key players who were active in the early 2000s. So we're going to be looking at a couple of groups that were known to work with Hell's Angels outlaw gangs. But from all I can see, the groups themselves that were in Cranbrook weren't Hell's Angels, but they were associated with them. They would do some work with them. Okay, so first we've got the Mahone Group. The Mahone Group was run by Doug Mahone. Doug looks like your average biker guy. You know, he's got a stocky build, he's 5'8", big beard, shaved head or short hair. He wears, you know, black wraparound sunglasses. He loves Harleys. You can probably picture him. And the Mahone Group were regulars at a Cranbrook bar called the Sam Steele. They spent so much time at the bar that they were referred to as the unofficial bar security. From time to time, the Mahone Group had run-ins with other local groups, such as the Davis Group. The Davis Group included a couple of key members who are important to this case. Their names are Colin Correa and Sheldon Hunter. Both Colin and Sheldon have long criminal histories. Colin's rap sheet features convictions for assault, firearms offenses, drugs, mischief, driving without a license. And Sheldon has been convicted in the past of assault, firearms offenses, drug trafficking, possession of stolen property, uttering threats, and even escaping custody. Indeed, with these two groups, there are court documents detailing fights, rivalries over territories, and a lot of gun stuff. At one time, Doug Mahone had been a trafficker with the Davis Group, but they had a falling out at some point. And now, the Davis Group wanted Doug and a couple of other fellows he worked with to be dead. You see, members of the Mahone Group had shot a member of the Davis Group outside the Sam Steele bar one night in 2009. The victim survived, and two members of the Mahone Group were charged with murder. At that same time, Doug was picked up and charged with trafficking drugs. My, what tangled webs we weave. Now, I'm not really telling you that story. I'm just kind of glossing over it to give you an idea of what was going on in the town at the time, just to kind of set the scene between these two groups, the Mahone Group and the Davis Group. Meanwhile, even gang members need somewhere to live, right? At this time, Doug had been renting half of a duplex. The owner of the house, his landlord, was Lise McFarlane, who, according to Facebook, seems like a firecracker and a real fun gal. She lived in the other half of the duplex with her son. The house was a little bit rural, on the outskirts of town. Seems like a nice setting to be in. But then one day, the renter, Doug, moved out. Or it appears he was arrested, so he just had to leave. Records state that on October 30th, 2009, there was a search of the property associated with Doug Mahone locating 20 individual baggies of cocaine, ecstasy, cash, and prescription drugs. So Doug was arrested and held in custody pending trial. During this time, Lisa's duplex sat empty. Doug would not actually come back there, so he was totally moved out. And when he was eventually released on bail, he went to his parents' house in Wassa Lake, outside of Cranbrook, while he waited to be sentenced. So now Lise had that empty half of a duplex. And at the same time, some of her extended family members were thinking of moving to Cranbrook to expand their family business, so it seemed like a perfect fit to have them move in right next door to her. The family members were Leanne McFarlane, Lise's sister-in-law, and Jeffrey Taylor. They had three grown children, and Jeffrey and Leanne had moved to BC in 2006 to be closer to Jeffrey's parents, who were living in Kelowna. Leanne also had a daughter in BC, so this was a good move for her as well. They ran a successful cell phone retail store called Shuswap Wireless Connections, and now they were ready to expand their business to Cranbrook. So Leanne and Jeffrey moved into Lisa's duplex. They had been there for 3 months and were adjusting well to the new town when tragedy struck. Now, just for a moment, I want to ask you to think about something. If you're at home on a Saturday morning at about 9:30 a.m., what are you doing? Are you drinking coffee, watching Saturday morning cartoons, lazing about in pajamas? Or are you getting ready to work out? Or are you getting ready to head to work? Maybe you're still sleeping. Jeffrey and Leanne were in their home at 9:30 a.m. on Saturday, May 29, 2010, when they heard loud bangs at the front door. Suddenly, two men burst through the front door. The men immediately confronted Jeffrey and shot him. Leanne, who had been sitting on the couch, was immediately shot as well. There was barely any time to react. This all happened very quickly because right next door, in the other half of the duplex, Lisa's son peered out of his bedroom window, which could see inside one of Leanne and Jeffrey's windows. He noticed the men inside their house, and he yelled to his mom, "Something's wrong." His mom was sleeping, but she immediately got up to investigate. She had no sooner walked out of her room when she was confronted by a man coming up the stairs with a gun pointed right at her. The intruder yelled, "Where's Doug?" and ordered her to get down on the ground, but she did not. Lise described thinking, "He's going to give me a beating if I get down on the floor." Instead, she stood her ground. The intruder pointed the gun right at Lise and pulled the trigger. The gun clicked, but it was apparently out of bullets. At that moment, Lise turned and bolted to her bedroom, where she hid between her bed and the wall. The men then left the house. Lise rushed to her son's room to check on him. He was alive, and she told him to stay hidden. Lise got on the phone with 911 and headed next door to check on Leanne and Jeffrey. We can only imagine the heartbreaking horror that Lise walked into. Leanne was dead from the gunshots, but amazingly, Jeffrey was still alive. He had mustered all of his strength to get to the phone and call 911. The ambulance came quickly and pronounced Leanne deceased. Jeffrey was loaded up into the ambulance, but sadly, he died on the way to the hospital. What happened at this house? Why had Jeffrey and Leanne been the targets of a deadly murder plot on an otherwise beautiful Saturday morning in spring? No one in their family had any connection to or history of crime, gangs, or violence. Why would someone do this to seemingly average folks who were just in their home minding their own business? Immediately, police began interviewing witnesses, anyone who had been driving by or noticed anything out of the ordinary. 6 witnesses shared statements of what they saw as they drove by, and they all mentioned 2 or 3 men in the ditch along the side of the road walking or quickly running with masks on their faces. There was no visible gun, though, or phones or blood, just men running with masks. There was also at least 1 firearm left at the crime scene, so the police sent it in to be gone over forensically. As they began their investigation, police knew that Doug Mahone must be connected to this. They knew that he had lived in the duplex before Leanne and Jeffrey. And since Leanne and Jeffrey had no relation to gangs or criminal activity, they thought it could be a case of mistaken identity. Retaliation. Someone wanted Doug dead. Police drove out to Wassa Lake, where Doug was staying with his family, and conducted a duty to warn. I wonder what that sounds like. Knock, knock. Someone's trying to kill you. Best of luck to you. So Doug remained at his parents' house, likely on high guard, but he also stayed somewhat busy as he later breached his bail, was rearrested, and then again released on bail to his parents' house. Next up, police began interviewing associates of the different groups in Cranbrook. It turns out that their most valuable witnesses would be two teenagers who worked for Colin Correa and the Davis Group. The teenagers often chauffeured Colin around and did little tasks for him. Because they are youth, they are referred to as Y and Z in court documents, and I will refer to them as Y-Man and Z-Man because saying Y and whatnot got kind of confusing. Both Y-Man and Z-Man sold and used drugs, and it seems they would do whatever Colin asked them to do. Z-Man testified to the police that he drove Colin and Sheldon to within walking distance of the murder scene, and then drove them to a different location to burn their clothing, and then drove them back to Cranbrook. By all accounts, Y-Man didn't have a lot to do with these events. But the police kept investigating, and the hands of justice moved slowly. After 5 years of investigation, the cops then tried to turn the brothers against each other, or against the group they're working for, by asking questions like, would you rather be pointing the fingers at the persons to be charged, or have the fingers pointed at you as the persons to be charged? They intended to scare the brothers into believing that they might be in trouble for the murders. With that questioning, Y-Man spilled a lot more beans. He shared all kinds of details about holding onto a gun for Colin. It was a black slide action with an ammunition clip on the handle. On May 28, 2010, the day before the murders, Y-Man said that Colin phoned him and told him to tell Sheldon to be ready. Y-Man was then directed to give the gun he was holding onto to Sheldon. What would he be ready for? Why did he need a gun? You know? Z-Man also ended up spilling some more beans. He said that on the morning of the murders, Colin told him that they were going to pick up Sheldon, and then they did so. Z-Man was told where to drive, and he showed the police the route. It was definitely near Leanne and Jeffrey's house. During the drive, Z-Man said that he heard Colin tell them they were traveling to a scene where a murder was going to be committed. So they pulled into a secluded area where Z-Man waited in the car. Sheldon and Colin got out of the car, retrieved items from the trunk, and then they left on foot and they were gone for a few hours. When they returned, they had pistols in their hands and blood on their clothing, which was visible to Z-Man. Now, as for the murder weapons, Colin was easily connected to a Smith & Wesson 44 caliber and a Webley 38 caliber handgun because his DNA was found on them. Also, the DNA of other members of the Davis Group was found on the gun at the crime scene, seemingly because the group would pass weapons around. That's really damning for the Davis Group. Time kept ticking on as the police collected evidence, and in the summer of 2010, Y-Man moved to Edmonton, Alberta. Colin and Sheldon also moved to Alberta, but the police kept watching them and kept trying to get more information in order to convict. I always think of the victims during these long investigations. While justice moves slowly, the families wait. And if you're someone who maybe testified to seeing Colin or Sheldon in an incriminating situation, you might be pretty nervous about seeing them from time to time in a small town or out and about. Thankfully, in the spring of 2013, three Cranbrook men, including Colin Correa, who was picked up in Alberta, were charged for hiring another longtime criminal to kill Doug Mahone. This was back in 2009. They had been plotting to have Doug killed. Now, in 2013, they were convicted and received sentences ranging from 5.5 to 12 years in prison. Note, Sheldon Hunter was not included in that conviction, so there must not have been anything pinning him to the planning process specifically. But at least for now, Colin was off the streets, and it was evidently clear that he had wanted Doug killed and made plans to have him killed. However, his time in prison was temporary. I read that Colin received a 12-year sentence for plotting the death of Doug, but then they subtracted double time for time served, I suppose, while he was waiting in jail. So minus 66 months, which would bring him to having 6.5 years left. Keep in mind, many folks only serve a third of their sentence, so I guess that's how he came to be out and about and living his life again after just a few years. Meanwhile, during this time, the RCMP started using two additional and complementary techniques to put pressure on Y-Man and Z-Man. One technique was employing undercover police officers to approach the brothers and tell them that they were associated with Colin and that they were seeking information about what the brothers intended to say to the police. So kind of saying, like, we work with Colin, we want to know how much you're going to tell the police, what are you saying, so we get our stories straight. On May 26, 2015, the police also went to the home of Z-Man's girlfriend. She was really upset and crying, and she told them that she was pretty sure Z-Man had driven Colin to the murders. So they've got their undercover cop, they're talking to family members, and then their next tactic was an informant. They secured an informant deep down in the gang world, and they slowly, slowly kept working to uncover more evidence. By 2015, the police in Cranbrook were reporting that they had severely cracked down on gang activity and that there had been a significant decline in organized crime and homicides in their community. So hopefully people felt safer. They also began new initiatives to prevent or reduce people from being tempted to join gangs. This can be so important, especially for teenagers or people looking for some belonging or some meaning. So all of these things are happening simultaneously, and there's mounting information, mainly coming from Z-Man and Y-Man. And finally, police were ready to submit a comprehensive evidence package to the BC Prosecution Service for their assessment of criminal charges. Indeed, those charges were laid, and finally, it was time for a trial to begin for the murders of Leanne McFarlane and Jeffrey Taylor. So this was the year 2018 when they were ready to proceed. And Colin, of course, was out of jail. He and Sheldon were both found in Alberta. One was living in Drumheller. One was living in Edmonton. So they were picked up, quickly arrested, and brought back to BC to be tried. There were other people associated with this case. Chad Munro and Daniel Fade faced weapons charges. Kevin Winters also conspired to commit murder. But this trial that we are looking at is just, of course, Colin and Sheldon being tried together for first-degree murder. This case hinged on four main points, it seems. Let's go through them one by one, and then you can see if you agree with the judge's assessment. We start with the blood. An undercover officer asked Z-Man if he saw blood on Colin or Sheldon after the alleged murders took place. Z-Man said no to the undercover officer. He said, "I definitely didn't see any blood on their clothes or anything." But then Z-Man changed his story. During a police interview the very next day, he said, regarding the blood, "Yeah, they were pretty covered." And over the next month, he was interviewed by officers again and again, and he always insisted that Colin and Sheldon had blood on them. Yet none of the highway witnesses saw blood on any part of the men's clothing that they saw walking along the side of the highway. The men who were assumed to be Colin and Sheldon. Each of the witnesses were asked again and again under cross-examination and said that blood was something they would have remembered. It would have stood out to them. They did not see blood on the two people walking allegedly from Leanne and Jeffrey's place. Lise McFarlane, if you recall, who owned the duplex, came face to face with the shooters moments after they killed Leanne and Jeffrey, and Lise did not see blood on their clothing. Her son, who also saw both suspects, agreed in cross-examination that he did not see blood on either person's clothing. And then there was testimony from Dr. Cockle, a bloodstain pattern expert and Crown witness, who testified about the likelihood of blood spatter patterns on the shooters based on the evidence before the court. She testified that it was very unlikely that one of the shooters would have blood on them unless they were standing closer than 60 centimeters from the victim. And there was no evidence that any of the shooters were standing that close or that they came into contact with the victims after they shot them. So it's assumed they wouldn't have blood on them. So why would Z-Man's testimony change? Why would he say he didn't see blood on them and then decide to put blood on Colin and Sheldon? Was it to make them seem more guilty, or had he really seen that up close? Lastly, regarding the blood, a bloody footprint was found in Leanna and Jeffrey's house that matched the style of Puma shoes that Colin Correa usually wore. Based on videos taken the night before the murder, it was evident that Colin wore Pumas just hours before the murder, and then a Puma shoe print was found in their blood. But after the murders, his Puma shoes could not be located anywhere. Had he disposed of them? Had he burned them in a fire? That brings us to our next major point, the fire site. During the investigation following the murders, police discovered a burn pit shortly out of town. There had been a fire the very morning of the murders. The police had a pretty good hunch that this could have been the fire site used to burn evidence, such as bloody clothes. When speaking to an undercover officer, Z-Man said that he had no knowledge of a fire or a burn pit. He told the undercover officer, "I wasn't with them when they did that," and he denied knowing of anything that had been burned by Sheldon or Colin. Yet just 2 days later, when formally questioned by police, Z-Man claimed that he did go to a fire pit with Sheldon and Colin, and that he watched them burn their clothes, shoes, coveralls, a backpack. They poured gasoline over all of it. Although when asked about the details, his story kept changing again and again. For example, little things like he told officers that Sheldon lit the fire with a matchbox from his pocket, and then the next time he told the story, he said Sheldon had a booklet of matches. Even seemingly small things like that cast doubt on Z-Man's claims. The police knew where the alleged fire had happened because they found the fire pit, and yet when they asked Z-Man to lead them to the fire site, he couldn't find the location. Z-Man led them down a dirt road into a clearing in a forested area, but the actual fire pit was just on the side of the road, several miles further along from where they had turned off. So what does that mean about Z-Man's story? Lastly, regarding the fire pit, I'd like to read you a quote from the court documents, section 118. "Finally, there is the question of a foil-wrapped, partially burnt hot dog among the contents of the fire site. There are several possible explanations for this, that just having killed two people and apparently in not much of a rush to get out of the area, the murderers had brought hot dogs for the occasion and had cooked them over the fire used to burn their clothing that Z indicates they burned there." It goes on to say that that's a possibility, or rather, the police coincidentally found a spot that some previous people had used for a fire and barbecue. So defense is saying that the fire pit was not a site that the two accused and Z-Man were ever at. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up cell phones. We all know about pings and whatnot. So let's see what the phones have to say. We don't have everyone's records, but Sheldon's are public here in the court documents. So let's have a look at Sheldon's phone records. On the morning of the murders, Sheldon called his girlfriend 3 times. He first called her at 7:23 a.m. and then 2 more times. The phone calls each lasted for just a few seconds. And yet, Sheldon's girlfriend said that they were together all morning long. Was it normal for Sheldon to call his girlfriend when they were in the same house together? She said yes. She said that if he wanted something but didn't want to get up, he would call her. At that time, there were 3 main cell towers in Cranbrook. On the morning of the murders, Sheldon's cell phone also pinged from a tower that would place him downtown from 7:23 a.m. until 10:30 a.m. And he made outgoing phone calls between 9:31 and 9:49, 4 phone calls, and then he received a call at 9:49 a.m. The numbers he called were all people that he was known to sell drugs to. And the court was asked, "Is it reasonable to imagine that he would have been busy dealing drugs while also traveling with a pistol in his hand on a mission to kill?" But then, Sheldon's phone switched from pinging downtown Cranbrook to pinging on a tower that covers Mount Baker, which could put him near the alleged fire site around 11 a.m. Yet defense argued that his phone pinged there at 11:12 a.m., which would actually put him there after the fire was already over. Our last point during this trial is the question of whether or not Colin knew that Doug no longer lived in that house. As I mentioned before, the Davis group was unknowingly in regular contact with an undercover officer. The officer was interviewed at trial, and he testified about going into Cranbrook on March 30th, 2010, 2 months before the murders, and tape recording a conversation between himself, Colin, and another associate. one of the topics they discussed was where Doug was. A partial transcript of the conversations is available online, so you can see that during the conversation, the fellows are saying how they need to take Doug out. And they don't mean a night on the town, they mean out. And they also want to take out a couple of other people associated with him. They wonder aloud if Doug is still in jail in Kamloops, or if he's at his mother's house at Wassa Lake. And they debated where he might be, and they talked about checking the court records. So with that information, it would seem that they knew Doug was no longer living in Lisa's duplex. So with all that information, the court had to make a decision. But could they trust the evidence that was presented? Were Z-Man and Y-Man reliable sources? There were a few issues. Counsel for Colin and Sheldon argued that Z-Man's evidence had been affected by external sources, such as the reading of newspapers. They claimed that he could have found a lot of the information he shared from the newspapers, and they called this tainting of evidence. They also pointed out that there were times during the police interviews that the police officers suggested important things to Z-Man. They argued that that was an improper interviewing technique. Defense also argued that the way police pitted Y-Man and Z-Man against each other and their group in order to get them to put guilt on Colin and Sheldon and exonerate themselves was improper, because it gave Y-Man and Z-Man no other option than to blame Colin and Sheldon. Therefore, they argued that Y-Man and Z-Man's testimony was tainted, unreliable, and even false. So this trial lasted 150 days, and then the judge presented their decision April 2022. Ultimately, the judge said that there was witness tainting, there was the pointing of fingers, and there were lies in order to obtain immunity. There were lies and more lies during interrogations. The judge said that since Z-Man was the main witness against Colin and Sheldon, they needed to be able to believe Z-Man's testimony, but they just couldn't. It left reasonable doubt because their story kept changing. The judge also noted that the two gunmen were disguised at the time of the shootings, and Lisa and her son were not able to identify them. Regarding Colin and Sheldon, the judge said, "I am not satisfied that the two accused persons are innocent. However, I'm also not satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that they're guilty." So, although Colin was found guilty of planning to murder Doug Mahone, he was not found guilty of the murder of Leanne and Jeffrey. Sheldon and Colin were found not guilty. Gasps could be heard in the public gallery when the judge read their decision. The families of Leanne McFarlane and Jeffrey Taylor were gutted. Leanne's daughter said, "It was terrible. We thought we would go there and have some relief. The trial was 3 years long, and it took almost 10 years for an arrest. We were already anxious, and to have that be the verdict? No one pays for what happened. They are released." Throughout the whole trial, we were under the impression that Colin Correa was sure to be found guilty. With Sheldon Hunter, sure, it was 50-50. But even Colin looked surprised when the judge read his verdict. And it goes on, "It's not like there was not enough evidence. It was 100% them, and they get no consequences for what they did. It doesn't seem fair." Leanne and Jeffrey's son says regarding the loss of his parents, "It never goes away. The time seems to have passed so quickly, it almost seems like yesterday. But we have to keep living our lives." In May of this year, on the Facebook page for Leanne and Jeffrey's case, see the link in the show notes, the following statement was posted. "Today is 12 years since we lost Leanne and Jeff because of two people that decided to take their lives and walk free due to poor judgment. Clearly are responsible, but get to be in the public to live their lives while we are suffering from losing these two. Hopefully, there will still be justice." And now I will share some updates with you. Where are they now? Since the verdict, the BC Prosecution Service has filed a provisional notice of appeal as it reviews the judge's ruling. The appeal says, among other things, that the judge erred in law by providing insufficient reasons for acquitting the two men and failed to consider all the evidence in the case. I'm thinking about that gun. There were a number of delays due to COVID, but hopefully we will have some updates soon about this review. As you know, Doug was convicted for the controlled substances, and so he went to jail for 4 years in 2012. And then when he got out, he had 4 daughters, and he went on to buy the bar, the Sam Steele. And then Doug died suddenly on July 4th, 2021. Sheldon Hunter was recently in the news again. He was arrested as the main suspect in a nearly fatal shooting in Cranbrook that happened on August 27th, 2022. Colin Correa seems to be laying low. I don't see any updates on him, but I am sure we will hear something again soon with regard to the appeal on the judge's ruling. And now for our special message. Anyone with information relating to this case is urged to report it. You can report anonymously. You can report tips through Crime Stoppers. You just phone 1-800-222-8477. You can contact the Cranbrook RCMP Detachment at 250-489-3471. Or you can email tipsforleannemcfarlane@gmail.com. A Facebook group has been set up related to the case. You can find it by searching Facebook for Leanne McFarlane and Jeffrey Taylor, May 29, 2010, Unsolved Murder Case. And that brings us to the end of our case. Lock your doors, folks, although I'm not even sure that would protect you if a gang wants you dead. Take care. Sorry to love you and leave ya. Bye-bye.